Accession number 28709, Real One.
Bunty Lawson, Real One. Now, if we start first of all with some of your comments about your life before you enlisted, that's probably the best place to start.
If I start, I left school in 1938. I left day school in Camberley in 1938, by around about Christmas time. And I was allowed to have a year at home, which was never quite completed because of the war, to do what I liked. And that was, I liked playing tennis and riding horses and going to dances. So I had an extremely nice year living in a very military area. My father actually was not in the army. He was in general practice at the village of Sandhurst, but nothing to do with the college. And Sandhurst was really still only a village then, but Camberley was a very military town. And since the first rumours of war happened in 1938, one had been brought up as to when war would be, not if. Preparations were being made. The cadets were taken away from Sandhurst in their middle term rather than completing their 3 years and sent to their regiments, so it was expected. I was actually at home on the Sunday when war was declared, and because it had been expected for so long, there was a slight, and I'm ashamed to say it, feeling of relief that it was actually happening, not when will it's going to break on us. And I decided almost there and then that I must join up. My father was in the RAMC in the 1418 war, and my mother was one of the early physiotherapists. My father had a tough war. He was in France, Egypt, and Gallipoli. And my mother's only brother was killed in the Royal Flying Corps when he was 18. So she was more the dreading war. Well, I think everybody was. But I think being then, aged just 18, there was an element of excitement in it. And I said I was going to join up straight away, which I didn't do for about 3 or 4 weeks. The only women that I had ever seen in uniform were the Fannies, who did their summer camp in Camberley, and they were all incredibly smart, beautifully cut uniforms. Most of them were drivers. I'd had about 3 driving lessons at this point, but I rather fancied myself as being a Fanny driver. I heard there was a recruiting office in Farnborough, so exactly how I got there I can't remember. I think I bullied my father into driving me there. And I was told that they weren't recruiting for the Fannies anymore, but I could join the ATS, which was the Army, or the Women's Royal Air Force. And so I decided I would join the Air Force, Women's Air Force. And there were 2 trades that I could have joined up with. One was mess and kitchen staff, which didn't sound very attractive to me. And the other was special duties. So when I asked the recruiting officer what special duties meant, she said she hadn't the slightest idea, but it did sound rather better than mess and kitchen staff. So I said, well, put me down for that. And feeling slightly stunned, I then returned home. I remember thinking then, what on earth have I done? There's no going back. If I hate the whole thing, I've got to admit defeat, which was something I was not very fond of doing. So I knew life was never, ever going to be the same. And I can't remember the exact time, but I think I was called up in about 3 or 4 weeks' time. And I was told to report to the recruit depot at West Drayton. And another girl from Camberley, who I didn't know, but we met at Camberley Station, she and I went out there together. I hadn't the slightest idea even where West Drayton was, but we found it somehow. And when we got there, we were taken to this camp, I think we were the first intake of women to this recruit depot. And we were given exactly the same training as the airmen had before us. We were in huts of about 33 to a hut. There were beds down either side. Each end of the hut, there was a big iron stove for heating, which we threw buckets of coke at occasionally. The entrance to the huts, there was a small bedroom where the corporal in charge of the hut was housed. Discipline was strict. There was a flight sergeant who was bossing us about the whole time. We were shown which our beds were. It was a little iron bed with not a proper mattress. They were known as biscuits. Your mattress is in three sections. So you had your biscuits stacked at the end of the bed, and then on top of that, in a special pattern, you had a pillow stuffed, I think, with straw. But I'm not sure about that. It was certainly not comfortable. And two sheets, and I think three or four dark brown, rather stiff blankets. And we had a small locker beside each bed. At first, we didn't have any uniform, and then we were issued with RAF blue raincoats and an armband, white armband with black lettering of WAAF on them. And I think we had hats at that point. Every morning we were on parade outside our hut, and we marched to the cookhouse for our breakfast. The cookhouse horrified me. There were bare deal tables, and you just grabbed at what food was going. I was absolutely horrified by the whole thing. And I think we were allowed to meander back to our huts, but otherwise we were marched wherever we went. And the sergeant in charge of us, I once stood out and said, "You can't speak to me like that." And I found he could. It was one of the first lessons for trimming me for size. Anyway, we were taught to march, to salute, who to salute and when, whom we referred to as sir, and we were only known by our surnames and our number. And we were given airman's PT. Fortunately, I was extremely fit at this point of my life. So that was no trouble to me whatsoever. Marching I found slightly futile, but I was young enough to try and do it well. And at the end of, I think it was three weeks square bashing, we were really quite smart. Well, I thought we were, and even the flight sergeant passed us. And then we were all piled into a bus and taken off to Leighton Buzzard to start our training as plotters, which was our special duty. That was really quite alarming.
Now, if I just stop you before we get that far and just
cover
a couple of areas that you mentioned to me, which were quite interesting. You were telling me about the medical that you had to have.
Oh, I left that without.
Are you prepared to tell the world?
Yes, I don't see why not. What should I put in? Just go back to when I was first called up.
Mm-hmm.
Will that do?
Yep, that's fine.
Am I on?
Yep.
Oh. To go back to when I was first called up, I had to go for a medical to Farnborough, to the medical centre there, where again we were treated as the men had been before us. We had to have a complete strip, completely naked, and a young MO came in. I was extremely embarrassed. I think he was as well. It was a rather fierce nurse with him as chaperone. And all I could think was try to carry this off as a joke. And I said, "Well, here you are, I'm presenting you with a very fine figure of a woman." And the nurse snapped round at me, "Don't be facetious. Be quiet." And that was that. Anyway, to go on back to West Rayton, we were taught then to be plotters, which I describe in more detail when I get to my first posting. But virtually it was tracing every aeroplane, friend or foe, that was in the air at certain times and over certain areas. The warrant officer who was teaching us this put the fear of God into us. It was heavily laid on that we had men's lives in our hands, and if we were careless or made mistakes, it would cause an aircraft to crash or somebody's death. To the extent that we were so frightened of making mistakes that one girl, when we actually were put on the ops table to put our plots on the thing, fainted out of sheer terror of doing anything wrong. I think she survived the course, but I'm not absolutely certain. It was a Mr. Drake who was training us, Warrant Officer Drake. And I met him later on. We were really mortally very frightened of Mr. Drake. I met him later on in the war when he'd been commissioned. He was then a pilot officer, and he wasn't impressive at all as a pilot officer. He was a warrant officer. He was going to be obeyed, whatever happened. Would that do for...
One thing I was going to ask you about also, did you have your full uniform by this stage?
By that stage, yes. Should I have put in the bit about...
It's worth a mention, actually, especially about the underwear.
Do you want me to do the whole thing again?
That's fine. If you just pick it up with... you were issued the uniform in stages, weren't you?
In stages, yes.
The mat first to cover your embarrassment.
Yes.
And then what came next? Was it the shirt?
The shirt and tie. To go back to when I arrived at the West Drayton training depot, and we were just issued with the raid coat. Shortly after that, we were issued with a blue shirt and a black tie. And terrible knickers, which had elastic top and bottoms. They were enormous. We all referred to them as passion killers. I don't think any of us ever wore them as pants. But they were terribly good at polishing the floor, because we had to keep the floor very well clean all the way around our beds. There were acres and acres of brown linoleum. Wherever we went, there was brown linoleum. And we were then told to stand by our beds, which was an order. So you stood at attention at the end of your meagre bed. And we were told to parade at the end of our beds in uniform. So I put on my... Obviously, indoors, I didn't wear my raid coat. So I wore my shirt and my black tie and my bloomers and no skirt, because I was still wearing a civilian skirt. And the corporal in charge of our hut finally persuaded me to put my skirt on. But I said, well, I was told to parade in our issue uniform, and that's what I'd been issued with. So that was what I was going to parade in. But she won, and I did happen to put my skirt on.
Did you get disciplined for that sort of behaviour?
I can't remember. I did know I told the flight sergeant he couldn't speak to me like that.
But you didn't get punished for that, you just got to...
But there was nothing they could take away from us. We weren't free anyway.
And then the other thing, again, when you were at your training centre, but also when you first got onto the base, did you have any special training for maybe gas attack or air raid or anything like that?
Oh, we did all that at West Drayton. Oh. We were actually put into a gas chamber. It made my nose bleed.
So what did you have to do? You just had to walk through it?
We had to walk through this gas chamber and then put on our gas masks to see that we put them on correctly. I never did get mine on because my nose was bleeding so hard that I was taken off to sick bay. So the intense fury of the flight sergeant.
And did you have any specific training for when the air raid siren sounded? Or
I can't remember any air raid training at all. We probably did. But there were, I mean, we certainly weren't any slit trenches or anything to get into.
So you never actually had to go through one?
No. I was never in one from the beginning of the war to the end. We finished our plotting training at Leighton Buzzard in about November, beginning of November, I think, and were posted up to 13 Group headquarters at Newcastle, where we were going to work properly in what was known as the Ops Room. The whole of the British Isles was divided up into groups. 10 Group was the West Country and South Wales. 11 Group was London and the home counties. 12 Group, and I don't know whether, can't remember where the headquarters was roughly sort of Middle England and North Wales. 13 Group was most of Yorkshire, all of Northumberland and Scotland. And I think right up on the west coast. And we were actually stationed in Northumberland, at Newcastle. And so we only had the map of the British Isles, was only our own area, and a little bit of the surrounding groups, where they overlapped. And the map we had was then drawn up into squares, with grid references on. And we had to put an arrow where every aeroplane was that was flying. Our plots that we were given through earphones came to us, some of them from the radar, which was very hush-hush at the time. We weren't even told exactly where this mysterious information was coming from. And the other was from the, I won't say civil defense, but that's not right. Anyway, people who were standing about and the cold Yorkshire moors and giving visual plots of aeroplanes. And every aircraft has a block of wood with the number of the raid, the number of aircraft flying, and the height they were flying at. And according to what instructions you were given through your earphones, you were with a like a couprier's thing, a long pole, we changed the position of each raid as it happened, or every day, when we, whether there was any aircraft or not, we had a practice hour to keep us accurate. And above us, on a dais, high up, overlooking the whole map, was the duty controller, who knew then exactly how many aeroplanes he had at his command and ordered their takeoff or their landing or anything else. And we had a lower dais where the raid recorders and map tracers were. There were two per watch because there was a 24-hour watch kept the whole time. And the raid recorders and map tracers kept a plot of every aircraft, every air raid, everything that was on the table at that time. And I was promoted from the actual plotting table up to do this because I was actually quite a accurate plotter. And I felt very exalted. It didn't make any difference to my rank. I had no other privileges, but it was much nicer to be up there. We had a vicious watch schedule. We had 4 hours on, 4 hours off, 8 hours on, 8 hours off, day and night. Occasionally we sneaked into Newcastle itself and usually went to Fenwick's for a decent meal. And in fact, they got to know us all quite well in there and really did us extremely proud because the food was appalling and I was duly thankful that I hadn't joined the mess kitchen staff, who had a terribly tough time of it. because we were actually billeted in brand new little houses on the outskirts of Newcastle. And for all these number of, well, I can't think how many we were there, but we were certainly in, you know, over 100. And there were none of these little modern houses had kitchens big enough for cooking for that lot. And they arranged rows of gas cookers in the garages. Well, Newcastle, being northeast at that time, was extremely cold. And the garage doors didn't fit right down to the ground. So these poor girls were cooking with a sort of 2-inch gap of ice-cold air coming in under the garage doors. And I must admit, their cooking wasn't the best. I can't remember eating anything except baked beans. We had baked beans for breakfast, we had baked beans for lunch, and we had baked beans for supper. And it was, I mean, they really had an incredibly tough life. They're obviously, being modern houses, they were bathrooms, but I never remember any hot water at all. I presume no boiler was put on for them. But at the end of the road, there was a doctor and his wife. I think their name was Jakes. And they were so good to us. They got so sorry for us. Actually, we must have been exasperated because we used to change watch outside their houses, waiting for our transport to come in at 4 o'clock in the morning, which can't have been very pleasant for them, because I don't think we were quiet the whole time we were there. But at Christmas time, they even invited a bunch of us in to come and have Christmas dinner with them. But best of the lot, they used to have us in for a hot bath when we felt like it. And I can remember being deeply, deeply ashamed of the awful black line I left around their lovely white bath. And I don't know that we ever thanked them enough. So they'll never know how eternally grateful we were. Well, I was personally. And the kindness of having us in there for the first Christmas of the war to share in their Christmas dinner was incredible. And I can't remember how many they had, but it was at least 6 of us, I think.
Now, can you remember any particular operations that you had to cover when you were plotting? Can you remember any particular raids? Any of them stick in your mind?
We plotted a raid out to Norway. And we plotted a German raid coming in to the Firth of Forth. And before we left, there were several raids, which we plotted then. And 603 Squadron were based with this fighter squadron, which were sent up to intercept them. They were an auxiliary squadron, flying Spitfires.
And how did you wind the raid down? How did you wind the operations down when you were plotting?
We didn't wind them down. If they went off your section of the map, you cleared away. Every 5 minutes, you cleared away. We had 3 colours that we plotted in, and the last colour was swept off the ops table, and then that was used again at the head of the next lot. So then it was either the operation was over and everything was cleared from the table, or it went on to the next sector and they took it over from us.
And when you say you used 3 colours, how did that work?
Well, the first 5 minutes would be yellow. The second 5 minutes, the arrows would be yellow. The second, they would be blue. And the third one could be green. At this point, I can't remember whether I got my colours correctly. And they were 5 minutes each, and the ops room clock was every 5 minutes. There'd be, well, say, from 12 till 1. That'd be a green strip on the clock, so you knew how long the plots had been on the table by the colour of them and the colour of what the clock was showing. I think at this point they still have one operational one. You can look at it at Uxbridge.
Have you been back to see it?
No, but I think I might be going. Am I on?
Now, how do you feel about going back there?
I think I'd rather like to see it. I'm not exactly homesick for it. But
you enjoyed plotting, didn't you?
I enjoyed plotting, yes. I'd have stayed plotting if I could have had a commission in the ops room, but I couldn't. The only chance of having a commission, you either change to administration or to codes and ciphers, and I chose codes and ciphers.
So at what stage did you make that decision, was it?
The summer of 1940. My name had been put up for a commission, which was then... I then went for an interview, which scared the daylights out of me, because I'm a very senior officer. I said, I see you're a good tennis player. Do you think you could defeat me? And with my thought by commission fading away and over the horizon, I said, I've never seen you play, sir. You just happened to be the champion tennis player of the RAF.
So the interview went well then?
Well, I suppose it must have. I think they were short of cipher officers. I don't think I should ever have passed that exam. We were actually taught by an Armenian, which seemed very strange to me. I don't know why. I wasn't even very sure where Armenia was or is.
Do you remember the name at all?
No.
Was it a man or a woman?
Woman. Oh, a man. A tall, thin man.
Now, before we get on to the next stage where you started your training, if we just, for the last, because we're coming up to the end of this reel, it just interests me, did you have any form of social life at all if you had such dreadful shifts of 4 hours on and 4 hours off?
Not much. There was one absolutely splendid girl who'd been a dancer in Monte Carlo at one of the casinos, and she dragooned, I think, four of us into doing a floor show. We used to practice in these ice-cold garages. And there was one corporal who was quite keen on me. So he said, well, as soon as your show is over, you will come and dance with me, won't you? And I said, yes, Ginge, I will. In the meantime, we used to go to the cinema to see, we had trade shows. And I think it was a Mickey Rooney one where the couple in it blacked up. So we said, what a splendid idea. So we blacked up as well. It was a terrible sticky paint of some sort. And we wore gingham dresses. And then to hide our hair, we had big gingham bows tied round our hair. Well, when our show was over, the corporal, who was in his best uniform, did not wish to dance with me when this awful black, oily makeup came off on everything. It took months to get it off your skin.
Did you get into trouble for that?
No, not really. Well, you see, I was clean from here down. Your uniform covered the rest of it. Your face had to be creamed up and cleaned off. Am I still on? Oh, because somewhere, and I can look it up, I was on B watch, and we were on duty on Christmas Day. And the air officer commanding, who was their Vice Marshal Saul, who we always referred to as God Saul, and because we were on duty on Christmas Day, he sent us down a tin of biscuits and toffees. So we wrote in the proper manner that you wrote to senior officers, sir, we have the honour to say we wish you a good Christmas Day. With amazing delight, we now chew as we write. And I can't remember the rest of it. I've got it written down somewhere. And I'd ended up, we have the honour to be, sir, the WAFs of Watch B. And we solemnly sent it up to him. Can't remember what his reaction was, not much, I think. But again, this was very much led by Phil, I remember her name, who'd been the dancer in Monte Carlo. She was very grown up compared with most of us.
Well, she was about the same age.
No, she was older. I should think she was in her late 20s. And we were all in our teens, at late teens or early 20s. Most of us had come from private schools. And at one point, we were told the airmen were mostly pitmen's son from Northumberland coal mines. And they were all far shorter than us. And we were told we weren't to just straggle into the ops room as we got off the bus. We had to march. Airmen were to march in front. So they marched in front and we came behind like a band of Amazons because we were all about a foot taller than the airmen.
I think we're coming up to the half hour now, so...
Our black sheep, have you any wool? Yes, sir, three bags full.
That's one lovely. That should be enough. This is Bunty Lawson, Reel 2.
Before I go on and with the cipher school bit, I'd like to recap